Welcome to the Procurement Show.
Hello and welcome to the Procurement Show, the show that tackles the topics we all need to think about and sets out to explore the more interesting bits of procurement. I'm Jonathan O'Brien.
And I'm Paul Philpott, and my role here is to sort Jonathan's extensive sock collection into order of most worn, kind of like first on, last off.
And the ones with holes in.
Yes.
This week we're looking at why new procurement tech implementations fail so often, and in particular, the psychology behind this.
The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, enabling the future of procurement in organisations around the globe.
And to help me, our special guest today is a three-time tech entrepreneur whose ventures have reached an astonishing combined valuation of over $400 million so far. He has been called a beacon of innovation and can boast that he knows how to leverage advanced AI strategies to solve complex technology challenges for businesses worldwide. In his latest endeavor, our guest shifts the paradigm from teaching computers to optimizing human capabilities with the goal of using AI to accelerate human progress like never before. He is doing this as CEO of Kinetic Talents and advisor to Apti, a company that helps individuals and organizations master their software ecosystems and digital transformation. Please welcome to the Procurement Show, Matt Palakderi. Matt, hello. Welcome
hello.
To the Procurement Show. It's great to have you join us today.
Thanks, guys. I'm thrilled to be here.
Which part of the world are you in?
I'm in Cincinnati, Ohio, and it's quite the rainy day here today, so I'm thrilled to be in the virtual office with you.
Yeah, it never rains here in the UK.
No, never at all. Matt, never. What's it like to be called a human beacon? That's quite a term.
That is quite the term. I'll ask my wife to start saying that around the house a little bit more.
There you go. See, there's a takeaway already.
There we go. Yes. So today we're talking about why software implementations fail, and I'm going to pitch straight in. Matt, why is new software implementation so difficult?
I think that is a question that a lot of people have been asking for a very long time. And the way that I think about it, I really view the challenges three primary buckets. The first being the integration side. And so the integration side has a bunch of complexities that come with it. I view the data side being a second challenge, which needs to be solved a completely different way. And then the third being more the change management side, and how do we get people to actually use the solutions that we build? And throughout my career, I certainly have focused in these three buckets in different areas. I've found ways to solve some of these problems more proactively. I've also tried things that haven't worked out in all three of these areas as well. So one thing that I'm really excited about what we're doing now is that I've shifted from more the data side to really how do we make these solutions as usable as possible for really the users that we're installing the platform for in the first place.
Matt, is it more difficult though when it comes to procurement? And if so, why?
I do think it's more difficult when it comes to procurement. And the reason that I believe that is procurement oftentimes gets overlooked within organizations. And I don't necessarily think that that's true at the leadership level like it used to be, but certainly at the employee level, I think oftentimes employees will view procurement as something that can get in the way at times versus a strategic asset. And I'll use a quick example, especially in the indirect side of procurement. If you can go and save $5 on new printer paper for your printer, well, if it takes you 30 minutes to check out, eventually somebody's just going to get frustrated, order from Staples or Amazon like they do in their professional life. They'll think the $5 really doesn't mean that much. I'll expense it. But then when you think about it as an organization, you think, hey, you know, I order 100,000 of these reams of paper a year, that $5 adds up very quickly.
Yeah.
And so when we think about the paradigm shift, it oftentimes what makes procurement really important is that the cost savings can be so large. However, it's a microcosm of all of these little purchases that add up to get you there. And if you look at the micro purchase in the grand scheme of how it adds up, sometimes the importance can get lost. And that's why I think training at this point is the biggest issue as it relates to how we get procurement solutions truly adopted.
Clearly, there's some cost implications there if we're not able to adopt the new software, especially if that's going to begin to drive the right sort of price cost points for something that we're buying. But it strikes me there's probably a lot of impacts here. So what are the consequences if we don't do good implementation? What's the consequences of poor implementation or implementation failing? What other stuff is lost here?
Fundamentally, people don't use the platform when it's cumbersome and it's hard to use, or if the data is just not right. And the implications from a cost perspective can be massive to the organization. I'll use a real example for you here. One of my favorite examples with a really large bank that I've been working with for years, they have $10 billion worth of spend a year that they want to figure out how they can reduce. And at the time we were doing an exercise with them, they categorized $1 billion of that as addressable. And for those on the show that don't know what addressable means, it just means that if we put contracts around that spend, then we can actually negotiate these bulk discounts, save some money as long as we put all the spend through any given contract. And in this case, they came up with that $1 billion of addressable spend. That then meant that they needed to hire a chief procurement officer. That meant they had to build procure tech solutions. They had to find a way to actually capture the negotiated discounts. They did a great job, negotiated a 20% discount, which meant that there was a potential of driving $200 million to the bottom line if people just use the platform.
Yeah.
They installed these platforms. And then what we did is we went and looked 5 years into the rollout, how was it going? And they had a 10% adoption. And so in this case, they were saving 20 million of the 200 million potential. And this is what I think makes procurement so important, is that there are very few areas in the business that you can have the massive $200 million impact if everything goes well.
Mm-hmm.
However, we haven't stressed the importance enough in the organization. We haven't made it easy enough for people to follow. And so with that 10% adoption rate, they just, quite frankly, weren't making the dent that was possible at that given point in time in the journey.
So the costs are much, much bigger here. It's not just about not realizing the cost savings. It's the human cost of people finding these workarounds, these other ways of doing things, or just not getting on board with the tech and doing the new, efficient, agile thing that the company's setting out to do.
Yeah.
That kind of questionable impact level, though, kind of makes me wonder if it's to do with training or awareness, whether those two aspects come into play. Are we just particularly bad when it comes to training people how to use and locate such examples?
Yeah, I think we've been really bad. And I don't think that this is just a procurement problem or a technology problem in general. I personally view the problem as just an issue on how we teach people in general. This goes back to even the school system. And when I think about the tried and true methods for things not to work, I actually go back to what we do in grade school and high school and college, where we stand up a course. It's many weeks long. There's days of lectures. There are hours at a time. We throw a bunch of information at people. And the retention of that information is very small. And I'm sure you guys know people in your lives that are incredibly smart individuals who struggled in school because of the way that we went about teaching them.
Yeah.
And my premise, and quite frankly, I think the way that teaching people is going to evolve over time, is that now that we know, especially how computers learn the best, we can take the same methods of how we teach computers and turn it around to teach humans. And fundamentally, one of the beginning pieces of how we teach computers to learn is to let them learn by trial and error, right? And so here now, in order to make people learn the quickest, they'll have a question. Right? They need that question answered immediately. And so in this case, let's give them the ability to ask the question, answer that question on the screen in a way that then they can learn, they can see the process go a couple of times, and then they won't need that answer anymore. And then they can move on to the next layer of questions to build on top of the foundation they've already built. If we go and we say, guys, I have this week-long training course, I put it all into my LMS, all these questions are answered, go find it. Well, all of a sudden, you've made this problem of them learning a pretty basic skill extremely difficult for them. And they've got really important things to do, right? Procurement is something they do on the side of their day-to-day job. It should make their life easier. It should drive a bunch of benefits to the organization. But we have to do it in a way that the users can understand how to do it as quickly as possible.
I want to bring Jonathan in on this, because the integration of training into an organization, its ethos and how it fits it, even within its calendar, can be quite a difficult thing to achieve. Knowledge penetration and also overcoming users' fears. Do you think that has a particular role to play?
It's interesting what you said. Companies put this onto their learning management system, and here's a course you can take. Most of the software training I've seen has been like that. And, you know, you do a bit of training and you sit there. Here's a screen. Here's a field. In this field, you enter this information. And, you know, you kind of lose the will to live about one
minute. Very engaging.
But that's how training's done. And that, but you're right, Matt. That isn't how people learn. You have to learn it. by actually doing it, which means if you're going to bring a group of people, you've got to actually give them the product and give them the scenario and have them navigate through stuff, and then they will learn. But organizations just don't approach learning with that stuff in mind. In fact, certainly in the UK, in most of Europe and the US, training is kind of one of those discretionary things in many cases, mm-hmm. that if we can afford it, we'll do something, but not if it costs too much money. It's not seen as a vital component of what you need to do. It's the first thing that gets cut when organizations are struggling. Arguably, it is the one thing that's going to guarantee success if you invest in good training, and there's a lot of really bad training out there, but good training where there are outcomes and a step change in how people do that. I think tech is the hardest thing in many respects, because if you use traditional classroom training approaches, it doesn't work. But you've got to get people to actually use the product, give them scenarios, and achieve outcomes to do that. And organizations just don't invest in doing that stuff.
Matt, do you agree?
I completely agree with you. And in fact, if we just go back to that large bank example, if they had 10% adoption today, even if I only get you to 30% adoption, because of the $200 million potential, that was an additional $40 million that could be driven to the bottom line. It's one of the most important things you can do within the organization is you put in all this effort for systems and tools to make your processes more efficient across the organization. Now you need to make sure that you invest in teaching people how to use them quickly and efficiently and get back to their job as quickly as possible.
So we've got to overcome the challenge of poor training. What other challenges do you see in doing this, Matt?
Oftentimes, when people think about training, they think about it in a course setting. And that is just not how I think about it. I truly believe that in any solution, and we can remove procurement tech in this case, that people learn by just interacting with a platform. And any time that that platform experience changes, there is frustration. And I'll use some examples from some of the best organizations in the world. If we go back when Facebook first rolled out their new user interface, that first month after they rolled out the new interface, people were threatening to leave. They had to put in buttons to make it so that you could go back to the classic version. Even though that there was so much more functionality, people were used to using Facebook in a very particular way. The same thing happened with Snapchat in a very large way when they rolled out their new user interface, a bunch more functionality. If you look today, it absolutely was the right move to go and put the new user experience out there and provide the increased functionality to the users. But there undoubtedly at the beginning is this frustration because now all the time they spent in learning a new feature is gone and people don't want to spend the time going and learning a new asset. And so here, what we have to do is we have to roll out new features in a way that users can understand, get to the areas that they used to use quickly, and then get them back into their day-to-day job. If we do that, we can eliminate the frustration side of it. And then we can work on the fun things like gamification in areas that then we can take the baseline that we've created from adoption and increase that further. But in oftentimes, I think people will rush to say gamification and not think about the immediate frustration that's getting in the way before you can get to the fun side of rolling out a new solution.
The Procurement Show, exploring the more interesting bits about procurement. And now, the procurement fun fact. This edition's exciting tale of preposterous procurement, bizarre buying, or simply saucy sourcing.
According to Peter Smith's book, Bad Buying, in 2019, McDonald's in Japan had to ration servings of French fries due to a supply shortage of potatoes. The problem was not the potato growers or the farms that brought the potatoes from the USA to Japan, but was due to industrial action by dock workers in the ports on the west coast of the United States that restricted the shipments. McDonald's responded to manage the risk by airlifting 1,000 tons of potatoes into Japan.
The Procurement Fun Fact. Contact us by email. hello@theprocurementshow.com. Send us a tweet @procurementshow or connect with us on LinkedIn. Search for The Procurement Show.
We've identified quite a few pain points here throughout the last few minutes. You mentioned about user fears. You mentioned about friction and frustrations. Yep. We also talked about you have to learn by doing. There are no shortcuts. People resist things. Anything that changes our routine, we don't really like to change our routine.
We fear change.
Yeah. So the resistance towards new software is obviously something scary that the user finds. It's something that the user, regardless of whether they do or don't, they will find to not have the time in order to learn it. How do we actually overcome that resistance to change? Is it also a communications thing?
I do think to some level it's a communications thing. And I think it's our job as people that are rolling out new technology in general to articulate the benefits better. And I'll use AI actually as an example right here. We see a flood of AI solutions that are coming to the market. And these things are making some individuals wildly more productive than other individuals. But if you look at what those individuals did that are using AI very effectively, they took a month off just to learn how to use AI. Most people don't have that luxury in their life. And so we have to find a way to give them the experience, to learn the platform, to go make some mistakes so that then they can get to the eventual benefits. And I think as long as we paint a North Star that tells them, hey, once you get to this level, this is all the benefits you will achieve. These are how much easier your life will get. Here's all the things that you used to waste time on that now are solved because of this solution we put in place for you that eventually gets enough interest in the change behavior. But then you actually have to roll it out and live by what you say and make it as easy for them to learn as possible. Yeah.
The month off to learn and all those kind of like amazing opportunities that you could give users. You know, if you go to an organization, the top tier management are going to say, hang on a minute, we haven't got time for that. Yeah. How do you upsell it? I don't mean upsell in terms of like add on value, but how do you sell it up the chain?
Yeah.
That's one of the biggest critical items. And in fact, that's something that I see being one of the main reasons that even we don't get rolled out at times. It's that the individual user understands the benefit massively right out of the gate. But when you talk about how do you go up the chain and pitch the value benefit to the whole organization, there have been a lot of methods that have been proposed over the last 20 years on how to teach people more effectively. Fundamentally, it hasn't lived up to the promise. I believe this has been done because we keep copying the school methods. We keep copying what we're doing in college and what we're doing in high school. And I would really question whether those are the most effective methods. In fact, I think there are countless studies now showing that people learn most just by hopping into work and starting to do their role. Yep. That same approach applies to our technology as well. So when you bring it up the chain, oftentimes what we do, and this is just our method, I can't tell you whether this is right or wrong at the moment, but what we do is we try to start really small. We let you see the adoption increase in a small subset of users. You get to see the frustration come off their faces and let them feel the tangible benefits. We measure everything. Then we boil that up in a way that says, hey, this is the benefit you've seen in this micro subset. Here's what you would see if you were in a bigger subset. And then we just try to see how we can expand our relationship throughout time. And to me, that's the real crux of it. This is an emerging thought. This is different than how we've gone about it before. You need to see the proof before you put in the big implementation. We've all been used to all sorts of technologies failing. And I think the appetite for these large big bang rollouts is just dwindling now. And we don't have to do it.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a motivational factor here as well. And I want to give you an example of a job that I did in a previous life where I worked for the central procurement function and we had lots of business units that were dispersed in various different geographies. And we had implemented a P2P system with a catalog buying system. And the idea was that the local business units would buy what they needed. They would call it off from the catalog and that's how they would operate because it's fairly sort of standard common products. And what happened was I was working closely with the business units and I'd go to a business unit and they would be sourcing the same thing separately from somewhere else. And I'd say, why are you doing that? And they'd say, because I can get it cheaper. And I said, hang on a minute, you know, we've done this central deal. Of course, it's going to be the best deal. And you look at it, and sure enough, they were getting it cheaper. So I went back, I took this back up the line. They said, oh, yes, but we've got to add our overheads on. Okay, didn't really understand why that would be a good line of defense. Took it back to the people in the depots and said, but we've got to add our overheads on. And they just went, what? And they carried on buying it. And it's one of those things that, you know, of course, that's a ridiculous scenario, because you, on the one hand, we'd task people with being cost conscious. And on the other hand, we said, no, you can't go and buy the cheapest option. You've got to buy it from the central deal because of some reason that didn't actually make sense. So none of them believed in it. They thought it was rubbish. It was head office doing crazy things, and they just ignored it. They didn't come on board. So it feels like there's this motivation thing for people to adopt technology. They've got to believe in it. There's got to be some sort of felt need that, yeah, this is going to really help the business. What do you think?
I absolutely agree with you. And I'll use an example that I've seen in my life that's very similar to this. And I'll keep the vendors' names out of this for their sake. But we had a very large client at the first organization that I built. In this case, this client negotiated really great rates with an office supply provider. But then they got the same complaints that were coming back from their users. Like, hey, I can just go down the street and I get this cheaper. We decided to do a little bit of an exercise where we went and we pulled all the pricing off the Punchout site. And then we pulled all the pricing off of the main website. And what we found is that in the core basket of items that were pre-negotiated, certainly those were cheaper than the other items. To make up for that, on the Punchout site, there were a bunch of other items that were outside of the contract that actually were hyped up a bunch more than the public facing website.
Right.
I think also we sometimes lose sight that there is a gamification on the other side of how can the vendor make as much money? What are they using as a loss leader to get you into the virtual store? And then where can they make their high margin dollars as well? And so that's something I think we need to be really careful about, is if we cater this experience to the user, we need to make sure we have total control over that experience, because there's always going to be players that try to get into that environment you've created and find a way to make as much money as they can in that marketplace.
So Jonathan's brought to us a historic example of a bad experience.
Yep.
Historically, is it a case of things have just not gone as well as they should have done? And that's kind of like led towards this issue of resistance that we have right now. Are we battling against old, out-of-date technology of this history of bad experiences? Or is there something a bit more deep involved? Is there a psychology that we need to start to understand and help people work through here?
I have shifted that it's more the psychology route that we need to understand when designing not only the systems and tools, but the processes and procedures that go around the systems and tools. And this has been a change for me over my career as well. I would say that when I first started designing enterprise software, I would look at what others were doing and say, I can do that better. And what I've come to understand is that it's almost never the software itself that breaks. We've gotten really great at writing all sorts of enterprise software, especially in this multi-tenant way where you're learning from a lot of customers all in one environment. But as we keep going, what we see is that usability and training is something that if you don't solve, people won't use it. And so this is where I think the psychology really lies, is that when somebody has a question, and this doesn't matter whether it's enterprise software or you're teaching your toddler on how they best learn, they have a question, you have to answer that question when they have it. If I go and I ask somebody, an elementary school student, to read a book, and they're not interested in reading that book at that time, their retention level is going to be nothing. You're going to give them a book quiz at the end of the week, they're going to make up answers, and they're going to retain nothing. However, if it's at the time where maybe they're learning about fish and then you have a book that is about fish where they can further their learning, all of a sudden the retention goes way up. You have to capitalize on when you have the attention of the human mind. And don't let that human mind lose the attention, right? Once you have it, keep giving more information. Let them pursue knowledge at their own depth. I can only speak for myself here, but there are days that will go by where I feel like they're non-productive days. I try a bunch of things. Some things will work. I feel like I almost have writer's block as it relates to building solutions. And then you will hit this stride where I can stay up till 5 a.m. just creating everything. And I've made the last 3 weeks productive because I got to that one day. When people get into that honed in space, you need to allow them to capitalize as much as possible. And to me, that's surfacing answers that come up as they come up in your head, so you can get the most out of that time where you're truly focused.
Oh, yeah. This is all about having the creative mindset towards technical solutions.
You know all about that, of course. But is there a generation thing here? So I'm Generation X, which I think is quite cool.
What happened to ABCD? I've really wanted to know about this.
Middle ages.
I have to Google the generation Z, X, E, Y.
So what are you?
I beg your pardon.
But you're Generation X as
I
well.
Definitely am a generation. Yeah. Am I an X?
I think so. I'm not sure. What about Generation Z?
I'll be an X. Who's a Z?
So younger people.
Oh, they exist, don't they? Yes.
They do.
Yes.
So I think if you were born from 1995 up to 2012...
They won't be listening to this show.
I think they will.
Okay.
I think you're Generation Z. So is there a tech thing here that there is a natural ease, willingness to adopt technology by Generation Zs?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to say Z, not Z.
Okay, yes.
Because it's global. Z. Even in the UK, we say Generation Z.
Yes.
I don't know why, but that's what we do. Matt, do you think there's a natural generation thing here?
Absolutely. I do think that, especially when it comes to technology, the younger generation adopts it quicker. Their whole life using solutions that we're trying to emulate in the enterprise space. But I don't think that there is a difference when it comes to generation, how people learn. So whether you're a Gen X, whether you're a millennial or Gen Z, you need to surface the answers when you have those questions come up. And that fundamentally is the area that I think all enterprise software has a lot of room for improvement is no matter whether you're really tech savvy and somebody that's used solutions your whole life, or whether, you know, we've migrated you off of using a typewriter, there still is a learning curve that comes. And then when you have the question, you need to be shown with as minimal friction how to get the answers to that question.
I'm still thinking about the Z's because I've got a fear that we've come to the end of the human race because we ran out of letters.
I think it'll start again, or it's hexadecimal.
A bit like car registration plates.
But I think I got that wrong. So you said millennial is different to Generation X and Generation Z. So I'm going to just Google this while we're live.
And if you've got a question to ask Jonathan, please don't make it to do with anything about generation characterisations.
Okay, so what is the Generation Z range? Are you a Generation Z or millennial? So Generation Z, 1997 to 2012. Yeah. Millennial, 1981 to 1996.
Yes.
Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah. Wow. I'm really pleased we've gotten to the bottom of that. Yeah. Bring back Clippy is all I say. Everything will be solved.
It's time to Ask Jonathan.
And today's Ask Jonathan comes from Kofi Owusu. In this world of digital procurement tech, leading the way on transforming how we work, why is it all the P2P software platforms are so poor with clunky functionality and look like they're set from the 1980s? Jonathan.
I don't know.
Ah.
I wish I did. But Kofi, you're absolutely right. Why? Because there are some big, big companies, billion-dollar companies that have been established for 20 years plus that have built this stuff, and yet the user experience is poor. Mm. It is like, you know, something that a college student had done. Yet these are the big platforms that big companies implement, and it should be better. I personally don't think there's any excuse for it. I don't know why, but you know what? I think that would be a great question to ask Matt, our guest today. And I think, Paul, you should ask it.
Ask Jonathan. Email your question to jonathan@theprocurementshow.com. You might be part of the next show. The Procurement Show. The latest thinking, the greatest insights.
When it comes to procurement technology, I've seen some examples of some pretty poor software platforms out there.
Yeah.
How much, in your opinion, is actually good in terms of user experience, customer experience, user interface, all that kind of stuff? Or actually, how much of it is still old and crusty and we're just squeezing the last few moments of life out of it?
You're asking a question that certainly is near and dear to my heart and how you design platforms from the beginning. And I think that there are two prevailing thoughts, and I am very biased that I subscribe to one of them. So I'll start with the one that I don't subscribe to. But we used to build solutions based on functionality. And so we would start with, hey, I want the solution to do X, Y, Z. I want to slice the data by A, B, C. You know, we think about all the different things we potentially want to do, and then surface it up in a UI. And when you want that much functionality, it's hard to make it very usable as well. And I think as we look at what has really succeeded in the B2C environment when designing all software tech solutions, and even the best in class enterprise SaaS applications, they do the opposite. They start with the user. They start thinking, what does your day-to-day life look like? And you build the functionality in over time. What I see is that organizations that choose the second method to designing their software platforms come out with very user-friendly platforms that if we teach the user how to use, you start to get a lot of success with. If you start with the first and you start with the complexity that you want to build in the platform, you're going to end up with nothing other than a very complex piece of software that takes a lot of training to then be able to get to an end result that may or may not be what you need in your business to begin with. And I tend to subscribe to that the easiest solution is the best solution. So it certainly is a bit of my philosophy.
Great tip.
So how can we do this differently? What does a great implementation look like? What do we need to do, Matt?
I would go back to thinking about what do we really need to have happen in those three buckets. And you can't think about one in a silo. You have to think about how do I get my integrations done effectively. I personally think if we go back 15 years, this may have been the hardest of the questions. I think it's the easiest of the questions now. I think there are really great solutions, and even a lot of the SaaS providers have gone and built integrations for you. So hopefully those are solved, but there are many different ways you can solve that problem if that's a particular issue for you. The second is a data issue. And I will say I've spent a lot of time in my career thinking about data. I think about data really in two levels. I think about the data that needs to be input into the system. So oftentimes you can think about your core master data as one of those inputs. And I think about data that comes out of your platform. This is more your analytics, things that get surfaced that you want to drive your business based off of. If you don't have the good input, you're not going to get the good output. And so that certainly is a problem. I personally believe that the changes that have been made in Gen AI over the last year and a half is making the data side of this equation a lot easier. Everything from transforming data to fit your data structures to language requirements are becoming as simple as writing a prompt. So I do expect a lot of things to continue to emerge on the data front. And so then it really comes back down to once you have one and two solved, how do you get people to use it as quickly as possible? And for me, I really like what we're doing in augmented reality right now, where we can then start overlaying things that are clear on a screen and start showing you processes and procedures, pulling directly from even all the documents that you've written internally, have an AI chatbot with you so that you can get the answers that can't necessarily be shown on screen. Be able to ask why. A lot of times if you say, hey, why do I have to do this? Back to the example earlier, I can get it cheaper from down the street. Well, if some person's asking that same question is going to be asked 100 more times. Let's find a way to scalably answer that question when you have it so that you can remove the objection and get back on path. And I think that this is really where solutions need to focus right now. Think about usability. Get your customers feeling, we call it time to first value, as fast as possible. When you get in, the appetite for people installing a solution and then having a year to get to the first time that you see value is a great way for you to lose the trust of the organization, for people to abandon the solution. So get that value to the user as fast as possible. And I really like the way that Google designs solutions as well. And one of the methods that they bring into their product design is they truly think about the areas that they can deliver what they call wow moments. And this is where they're not everywhere in the platform. They're only going to be a couple of spots. But when you deliver data, for example, in an area that they didn't even know was possible, and so you surface something to them, maybe you show them a price alternate. Maybe you show, hey, if you did XYZ, you would cure this problem. There's all sorts of ways that you can take the input of the data and then surface something that further completes the understanding of the user and helps the organization capture more benefits. If you focus on those wow moments, then we really can get the users to adopt the platform and view it as an integral part of their life versus something that's really more of a burden to get through.
I got to say, I'm really, really excited and really interested to see when and where natural language interfaces are going to replace menus, drop downs, sure. Click-throughs, all that kind of stuff in everyday software, and indeed within the procurement area. So you've got an interface where instead of running a report or choosing a drop down list for whatever the reason may be, you either speak to or just type in the question, how soon are we going to be at that stage? Because at the time of recording, we're not, but things are moving so quickly. And also, how do you envision it to be integrated into the kind of software we use?
We can do that today. And so the way that we do that now is that we have an LLM that we can consume all your policy documents. That way we can answer your questions. When we answer your questions, if it's something that can be answered via text, it will be answered in the chatbot. If it's something where we actually have to teach you, then we will show you on screen. We can say, hit this tab, then the next tab, get to where you want. Once we have enough training data, actually, the second part of this is let's use the RPA just to complete that process. So now let's say I'm starting in my single sign-on. I don't know how to submit a purchase order. I should just be able to say, I need to submit a purchase order, and we can automate the task through your SSO directly to where you need to be and then allow you to type in the information. And we can put data validation rules around that so you do it the right way the first time. And then all the data funnels up into your analytics, which then solves part of the second piece of the data problem, right? Is that if we get the inputs correctly, then downstream the functionality works the way that you intended it to be from the first place. But I think you hit on the core piece there. Is when we think about the user experience side of any rollout, whether this is designing a platform yourself, whether you're implementing it for your business, you need to think about, as my user comes into this platform and has a question, how do I get them to the part of the platform so that question is answered as quickly as possible?
Wow. The future is really exciting.
It's scary too as well.
Talking of the future, it's come to that part of the show where I'm going to be thinking about the weekend.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I really like a good user experience. I like to
order
online.
I know where you're heading.
Yes. Order online with a succinct list of options. Mm-hmm. I like a fast, hot delivery service.
And you like it integrated.
Integrated, yes. Especially when it appears on the plate. Quick opening of the packaging. I'm talking about takeaways.
Yes.
So, Matt, what are your three top takeaways, please?
I absolutely believe that first and foremost, when we think about rolling out platforms, we need to think about surfacing answers as questions come up. If we make people wait on that answer, you will lose the interest and you will not get to the change behavior. That's first and foremost. Two, I think when we talk about implementing best-in-class software for any organization, regardless of whether this is procurement technology or a technology in another part of your business, there are three primary components you need to focus on: the integrations, the data, and the training. All of them help each other in some way or another, but I believe that if we start in the training aspect, you're going to naturally get better data, which will then maximize the usage of your integrations. This is kind of the opposite of what I think the world would have thought 10, 15 years ago. And then third, and certainly not least, is that we have an opportunity here with procurement tech to drive significant bottom line impact to organizations. In the way of that is training. And if we focus on that, we can drive sometimes tens to hundreds of millions of dollars to the bottom line and be one of the most impactful areas of the business. And I think that CFOs certainly are starting to understand that. I think CIOs are starting to understand that. And if we make these solutions as easy as possible, what we're going to see is that the level of organizational insight to procurement will continue to go up and up because of the value that is being captured, not promised, by procurement.
That's brilliant. It is as simple as that. Matt Palakderi, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a delight to have you on The Procurement Show. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
You've been listening to The Procurement Show. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com. Connect with us on LinkedIn, search for The Procurement Show, and on Twitter, @Procurement Show. Visit us at theprocurementshow.com. The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, enabling the future of procurement in organizations around the globe. Copyright Positive Purchasing, all rights reserved. Produced by Fresh Air Studios.